Hello and welcome to At Home This Morning, a magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. I'm Richard Davis, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. Coming up in that time, we'll be hearing about the reopening of the Volks Railway, following a period of several months when it's been closed for a major refurbishment. Then, the Sussex Police will be telling us about online fraud and what you can do to guard yourself against it. And we'll be hearing about the poetry competition which Brighton and Hove Arts Council recently ran, and the one-day poetry festival which follows it. As usual, we'll be giving out various phone numbers, email addresses and website addresses during the course of the programme. So you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. So let's start with the Volks Railway. As I said, it's been closed for some months now, whilst undergoing a major refurbishment. But it's now partially open again, and running over about half the distance that it normally covers. Chris English went along to the opening, where he bumped into TV newsman Nicholas Owen, who in his spare time actually works as a driver for the Volks Railway. And Chris put it to him that this reopening was a great occasion.
Yes, wonderful. After quite a long period, months, while we've been doing all sorts of work on the railway, all sorts of new buildings at the Aquarium Station, where we're speaking now, new depot, which is absolutely marvellous. It was terrific to get back this morning and had a lot of people come along, a lot of passengers, fare-paying passengers, which is so important.
And you're driving?
I'm driving, yes. There's a tradition here, going back to 2008, that I always drive the last train of the season and the first train of the season. So although this isn't a sort of real seasonal opening, I was very lucky to be able to drive the first one.
Now, the Aquarium Station looks very smart. Doesn't look very much like a station, but
very
that's
modern.
Architects for
a
you.
A modern station, a very modern station.
But the sheds aren't open yet, so is it running the full service?
No, we can't run the full service yet because the sheds are right across the track at the halfway point, so we can only run just short of that. There's a lot of work to go on inside to fit them out properly, fit the sheds out properly, have all the modern facilities, which Volks Railway has lacked all these years since 1883. Finally, we have modern place for people to work on the trains and do the maintenance and so on. And particularly the full-time staff, they deserve that. They deserve the best.
They work very hard.
And up to now, they've been places that have been drafty, have been wet, and finally they'll have proper modern conditions, thank goodness.
Now, the volunteers, I gather, from the Supporters Association have done a lot to get everything back on track.
The volunteers have been terrific. The members of the VERA, the Volks Electric Railway Association, lots of them turning up for days and days, right the way through all the rebuilding and project, doing all sorts of jobs. They've been absolutely vital. This reopening would not have occurred without them. So we're very, very grateful and well done to all those volunteers who turned out in all sorts of weather. Hasn't been a very nice summer, you know. And so they had to work hard, sometimes in the rain, sometimes in the wind, and so on.
Have you been down doing your bit?
Well, I used to do my bit. I'm very proud of the fact I was the first volunteer years ago who came down in the winter time to help the full-time staff. My job these days, I've reached the age of 70, you know, and I'm still allowed to drive, which is lovely, but I prefer not to sort of wield heavy machinery and so on. Take a sensible view. And I went to the general manager. I said, I'm awfully sorry. I can't be doing this anymore. And he says, quite all right. You can do other things like be interviewed by you, for example, which is great fun.
The public face.
The public face. Well, I think it has been important, to be honest, that we have had a public face, myself and others, to make the case for this railway. It's an extraordinary thing, a wonderful relic, Victorian relic, and it needed bigging up, as a boss of mine once said in television news, and we've done that, and I'm so pleased to see the results.
Now, you talk about television news. This is far removed from your day job. So why?
Well, I've always loved railways. When I was asked in 2008 to declare open the 125th season, I said I would do it as long as I can understand this railway. Come and show me everything and understand it from beginning to end. And they said, well, if you could become more involved and be one of our drivers, our part-time drivers? And I said, oh, yes, of course. And that's why I do this now. I often say to people, television's a hobby, you know. This is the real work here.
And I gather you've got to go.
I've got to go. Somebody's, one of our very important people has said to me, come on, the timetable. We're due to go any moment now, yeah.
So when do you think you'll be running the full length?
I think it probably be in the new year. There's an awful lot still to do. We won't run right through the depths of the winter anyway. And then we can do all the work. And we also need to do some work on the track beyond, up towards the other terminus near the marina. And once we get all that together, it'll be fantastic. 2018, we'll be running the full service with some modern station, modern depots, but the same old trains, all in a beautiful state. Track repairs done. It'll be fabulous.
Nick, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Lovely.
Right, ready to go, chaps. Ready.
We've just heard from Nick Owen from BBC Television fame. Another person that's not quite unfamiliar with television, the chairman of VERA, the Vulture Electric Railway Association, Ian Glethill. Ian, how delighted are you that the railway's running again?
We are. Well, I'm particularly very pleased. It was touch and go. There have been all kinds of problems. The building work's been delayed, the electricity couldn't get switched on until only 2 days ago for the first time, but we've opened it and there's been people down and we're delighted to see it running after well over a year, so we are thrilled.
How many of the refurbished cars are here?
Only one so far. Three were sent away. Car number four arrived just last week, and the builders, Alan Keefe and Company, they've done a fantastic job on restoring it. It's just wonderful. It puts the other ones to shame, I have to say. We're going to have some serious work on refurbishing 7, 8 and 9 to make them look anything like what 4 looks like. And then we're waiting for 6 and 10, which will come in a couple of months' time.
Here we are in mid-October. Originally, it was planned to reopen in June. What happened?
When they started the building work, they had to demolish the old buildings, and one of the problems with the car sheds was an unknown gas main which hadn't been used for years. Nobody knew it was there, and as soon as they discovered it, of course, building work had to stop. So the corporation approached the, I'm tempted to say the gas board, I know it's not them anymore, but whoever is responsible, and they said, oh well, yes, well, we'll put it on our list of things to do. But because it wasn't an urgent thing, it took several months, and it's just delayed the whole project. But now it's up and running.
And not, as we heard from Nick, it's not running the full length.
No.
When do you think that will happen?
The builders say they've got about another 4 weeks to do on the car sheds. We cannot run through the car sheds until that is complete. So certainly for our planned operation, which is from now until Veteran Car Run Day, we will only be running halfway. But after the middle of November, the built sheds should be finished. We should be able to start running through. So there is a possibility, I'm not making any promises at this stage, there is a possibility we might be running a few weekends up to Christmas, but that is still in the pipeline. But then obviously the railway will close for the rest of the winter and we'll have a grand reopening in the spring where we will operate the whole length of the line.
With the new cars?
With the new cars. Certainly number four will be operation by then. Hopefully 6 and 10 will be. So we will have 6 cars on the railway. We can operate more frequent trains if we need to when we have busy periods. So the future looks very good for the railway as it stands.
What about the role of the volunteers? That seems to have ramped up a bit.
I think, and I'm sure Stuart, the manager, would not mind me saying this, I think the railway could not have got to the state it's in now without the volunteers. The volunteers have been an integral part of the lottery bid that's got us the £1.65 million. Without the community support that the volunteers have provided, the lottery bid wouldn't have been made. So they needed us for that. And the railway only has a full-time staff of 3. And there is so much work to do. There is no way that they could do it on their own. So I think we've become almost essential to the running of the railway. I'm sure the council could manage, but I think they manage a lot better with our help.
And the volunteers are running the railway now, aren't they?
Yes.
On the reopening.
The current railway is staffed entirely by volunteers. The drivers and the ticket collectors are volunteers. Obviously, the railway management are here supervising, but we are running the railway as an efficient operation from now until we finish running in November. So.
And do you think that will continue in the future?
I think there will be a place for seasonal staff, because at the moment, you know, we are volunteers. We have lives of our own. We cannot necessarily, as volunteers, all come in 6 days a week. So we've made this commitment that we will for the next 3 weeks. But after that, at the moment, there will be a place for seasonal staff. Maybe in the future it could be more so, but it depends on being able to get enough volunteers to do it with that commitment. Because if you commit to running a volunteer railway, it is an enormous thing to ask of people to give up their time every day.
Do you think there's a need for more volunteers?
We could always do with more volunteers. There is always more to do. For the last few days, there have been a lot of people working on the track, but I've been cleaning the train ready for today, and I've been doing that mostly on my own. I've had a couple of people help, but there's always things like painting trains, cleaning trains. You don't have to wield a shovel or a pickaxe every day like the track gang do, but they seem to enjoy that kind of thing. I'm getting a bit old for wielding a pickaxe, so I'm painting trains at the moment, which is very enjoyable. Yeah.
And is there a need? We identify there's a need for more volunteers. How can people get involved?
They need to get in touch with VERA, that's the Volks Electric Railway Association. We have our own volunteer officer, who is Adrian. Get on our website. We have a website, volkselectricrailway.co.uk, and details are on there, or just come down the railway. We have regular volunteer days on Mondays and Thursdays, so if you come down to the railway at 9:30 in the morning, meet up and say, I'd like to volunteer. You have to be a member of VERA. So if you're not a member of VERA and you want to volunteer on the railway, come down, we'll give you a form. You have to be a member of VERA so that you're insured for working on the railway, because if you've just come down as a member of the public, you're not insured, but VERA members are covered by the council insurance.
And so the future, you think it's bright? It wasn't looking that way a little while ago.
It wasn't looking that way, but the railway now, with the lottery money, is now in a better state than it has been in probably 50 years. The track work has all been relayed by volunteers over the last few winters. We have brand new car sheds with a new restoration workshop, which has got good conditions for keeping the cars in tip-top condition, which we haven't had before, because the old car sheds were not fit for purpose. All right, I mean, they were built by Magnus Volk in 1884, so they were a historic building, but you couldn't jack a train up inside them. They weren't heated, they weren't waterproof. We couldn't maintain the trains properly, and now we can.
And so the future looks bright?
I think it does. The future's bright, the future's Volks.
Ian, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Chris English was talking to the TV newsreader Nicholas Owen and to Ian Gledhill, who's the chair of the Volks Electric Railway Association, about the reopening of the railway, which has just happened after a major refurbishment. Well, Chris is also involved in our second item today, and here he is to introduce it.
Now, fraud in one kind or another is regrettably increasing. And with me at the moment is Bernadette Laurie, who's Financial Abuse Safeguarding Officer for Operation Signature, Sussex Police. First of all, what is Operation Signature?
Operation Signature is basically our response to vulnerable victims of fraud. So it's a process that we've introduced to identify, protect and support vulnerable victims of fraud, which is predominantly the elderly. And the reason the elderly are the most vulnerable to fraud is a number of reasons, but it's partly a generational thing. They are more targeted, partly because they are at home more. They're at home when the phone's ringing. They're at home to answer the door. They have less technical ability when it comes to computers and things like that. And they're from a generation that have been brought up to trust people, whereas the younger generations are being brought up to be quite suspicious and untrusting.
So what can people do about that?
The most important thing, really, is to be on your guard. Do not believe everything that you see. Do not believe people are who they say they are when they're phoning you up. They could be anybody on the end of the phone. Just because they say they're from the bank or from the police or something, it doesn't necessarily mean they are. And it's to start to think twice. If something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. You can't win a lottery you haven't entered. You know, if somebody's cold calling at your door, you know, you haven't asked for that service, what are they doing coming to you? And it's the same. We see people phoning up pretending to be all sorts of different people. So the first and foremost is don't believe anything at face value. Think twice, make decisions in your own time. But also look out for your own friends and family and neighbours and things, because often you're not the only person that's being targeted. So if you've had a phone call or an email, talk about it with people and start to share those experiences so you know what to look out for.
Now, I'm sure I'm not alone amongst our listeners to have had nuisance phone calls that come from an undisclosed number or out of the area or something like that. We don't answer them. Is that the right thing to do?
It is the right thing to do, but of course we should be allowed to answer the telephone in our own home, you know, and so it's wrong to think that that phone should be ringing and you should be ignoring it. It's wrong that the fraudsters are having that avenue to contact you. We use a call blocker called Truecall, and I don't know if you could put maybe a link on your website or something to that. They're a very useful call blocker, which basically you can have a number of different settings, and it means that the calls are filtered through. So you get to speak to all the people you needed to speak to, but you don't get to speak to the silent callers, the withheld ones, the fraudsters trying to con you out of your money.
What about Truecall? Is there a cost involved?
Yeah, so to purchase the device is about £100. You can get them from Argos, from Amazon. We do have a funded supply ourselves, which we do install for the most vulnerable. And if you do purchase yourself or via us, you know, we do have a consent form to share that data, anonymous data, of course, to share that data with the National Fraud Intelligence Bureau to try and actually collate some of the intelligence around who is making these calls and really try and work with Ofcom and the Information Commission and try and do something about it.
I mean, how prevalent is it, this fraud online or on the phone?
Well, fraud in general is the fastest growing crime type, and that's for a number of reasons, but not least because of the advances in technology, and also because the returns are high. So compared to burgling a house, the risk of getting caught is quite high, the sentence is quite tough, and the reward is actually some second-hand goods to sell on. Fraud is so different in that the returns can be so high. You can send emails, you can do telephone calls on such a mass scale that you can hit so many people in one day, and you don't have to be local to do it. So a lot of these frauds are operating from abroad. So again, for that reason, the chances of them getting caught and punished is very slim.
Now, if you think or you have been affected by fraud, we all know that police forces everywhere are under extreme pressure, and it will only turn out to the most important crimes. What will happen if somebody dials 999 and says, I think I've been the victim of fraud?
If you've been a victim of fraud in Sussex, we would encourage you to phone the police straight away if you're vulnerable or if you're elderly. If the crime's in progress, obviously phone us on 999, otherwise 101. And if you are identified as vulnerable, we will attend in uniform and carry out a face-to-face visit. And we find that as a really important part of this process, because quite often people might be reporting one fraud, but in fact there's other frauds going on and they may be unaware that they are involved in that. So, for example, some people, you know, you might think you've got some legitimate investments and you're actually being targeted by investment fraudsters. Or, you know, you're involved in a romance fraud, which can, you know, surprisingly happen to a lot of elderly people. And again, charities, things like that, you might think you're donating to legitimate charities, but on closer inspection, they could also be fraudulent.
Now, you talked about elderly and vulnerable. None of us, even if we're elderly, like to be considered vulnerable. So what is your criteria?
We define vulnerability to fraud. So it's not about saying that a person can't look after themselves. It's about saying that the person is vulnerable to fraud. Now, one of the reasons the elderly are targeted is because they've got more money. So when you're 17, you might be vulnerable to other crime types, but fraud probably isn't the one, because you've, A, probably not got the money, but B, you've got your whole life ahead of you where you can re-earn that. You've got the opportunity to get that money back. When you're elderly, when that money's gone, it's gone. And that makes you vulnerable to fraud, because fraudsters are deliberately targeting you because you've got money. And when you've lost it, you've got no way of getting it back. And that's why if you are encouraged, which fraudsters will do, encourage you to take out equity of your properties, take out loans that you can't afford to pay back. And as your health deteriorates and you get older, then obviously you are going to be more vulnerable.
And is there a simple message that you can give people if they think that they might be targeted?
We have some really key main messages that I would like to just re-emphasise. And one is, check people are who they say they are. And if you're not sure, don't open the door. There's no obligation on you to open the door to people. Never send or give money to anyone that you don't know or trust. And remember to protect your identity. Don't share your personal information with other people. Never share your PIN number. Never enter your PIN number in the phone. The police, the bank, whoever it is on the phone, they will never ask for your PIN number. And if in doubt, phone a relative or a friend or somebody that you can trust. Never feel pressured to make decisions when you're put on the spot.
So the answer is, if in doubt, ask.
Yes, basically.
And are the police able to ask? I mean, the days of coppers walking up and down the streets are probably gone, aren't they, in all honesty?
Yeah, and a lot of advice and guidance is online these days. So a lot of the things, if you have got access to a computer, Action Fraud is the centre national recording place for all fraud, and they've got some excellent advice on their websites. We produce a monthly fraud newsletter in Sussex where we can offer additional advice about current frauds and trends. Loads of people in the community now that are looking out for these exact crime types and these people.
And you talked about websites. Is there a particular website?
Yeah, through our external Sussex Police website, so www.sussexpolice.co.uk, if you go to there and you'll find the fraud pages. Within the fraud pages, there's extensive information about all fraud types, and there's a big section on Operation Signature. And contained within that, there's a couple of films and guidance, and there's some downloadable leaflets and products and things like that. But also, you can go into your local police station and pick up a little book of big scams, which covers all the current sort of frauds that we know about.
And we've heard recently that there is a bit of a barrier, perhaps, between the police and the general public. Is that an accurate one, or is that a misinterpretation?
Certainly nothing that I've seen in this role working with vulnerable and elderly people around fraud. I think it's a very interactive and we've done a lot of training with partner agencies. We've done a lot of work with the Elders Commission through the Police and Crime Commissioner's Office, and I think that relationship is very, and also we work a lot with Neighbourhood Watch and it works very well.
Is there a message that you should be frightened of being online?
No, not at all. We really don't want to alarm people. We just want people to protect themselves. So, I mean, certainly protecting yourself, protecting your devices, using secure passwords, things like that. You know, we don't want to scaremonger here at all. We just want people to be aware of the facts and just to be aware that fraudsters are out there.
And those bullet points again?
Okay. Check people are who they say they are. If you're not sure, don't open the door. Never send or give money to anyone you don't know or trust. Remember to protect your identity and don't share your personal information with unexpected callers. Be aware of email and computer scams and treat all emails from unknown senders with suspicion and never click on links within them. Never share your PIN or enter your PIN into a telephone, and if in doubt, phone a relative, friend or someone you know and trust.
And the Sussex Police website?
www.sussexpolice.co.uk.
And you can find fraud easily on there?
Yeah, the fraud is accessible from the first page, and then as you go on, there's an Operation Signature page that you can visit.
Bernadette, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris English was talking to Bernadette Laurie of Sussex Police on the subject of online fraud. If you'd like to know more about the subject or to get advice from the police on how you can avoid becoming the victim of online fraud, you can go to their website, which is at www.sussexpolice.co.uk. That's www.sussexpolice.co.uk. Or you can phone the police on their non-emergency number, which is just 101. That's all you have to dial, 101. And that's the non-emergency number for getting in touch with the police. Or, of course, you could go to your local police station and ask them for information, as they have booklets that they can give you which will give you good advice on how to stay safe online. Well, a few weeks ago in this programme, we talked to Jason Squire of Brighton and Hove Arts Council about a poetry competition which they were organising. Well, the competition has now taken place, and Jason has come back into the studio to give us an update on it. Welcome back, Jason. How did the competition go?
The competition was extraordinarily successful. In terms of numbers, we had nearly 600 entries, triple possibly from last time. So we were delighted with that number.
So the competition is now closed, presumably. Has a winner been selected?
The competition, as you say, is now closed. It's all being judged by a Dr. Jess Moriarty, the head of department at the University of Brighton. And when I told her that she had 600 poems to judge, I think she nearly fell off her chair. But anyway, she is now, right now, frantically judging those 600 poems.
And when will the result be announced?
The result will be announced, in fact, at the Poetry Festival. But the winners, as it were, who are in the frame, will be advised that they have won. We're not going to tell them who's won first prize and who's won third and who's been highly commended. But they'll all be advised a few days before the festival.
Have you had a chance to look at any of the poems yourself?
I haven't had a chance. There's a colleague of mine who has very kindly sifted through all 600 of these poems. And it's quite a job because the poems have to obviously be entered anonymously, or at least the judge cannot see the name of who's written that poem. All she can see is a catalogue number. But I'm sure there will be a fantastically high standard of poems.
So you're not able to tell me anything about the poems, not having seen them?
I'm afraid not, Richard. We gave them a limitation of 40 lines. And we decided also that it was an open subject, so they could write poems about any subjects they liked. So there's no restriction in that way. So I would be expecting drama, humour, pathos, all manners of poems from the good people of Brighton and Hove. And I should also say, of course, entries from students around the county as well.
And that's a separate competition, isn't it?
There are two competitions. There is an open competition where the winner will win a prize of £1,000. And there are other prizes as well of £250, another prize to the value of £250, which is donated by the University of Brighton, which is a course on work, write and live. And then there will be four other prizes of £25. That is the open competition where people paid to enter. The second competition was open to students only. It was free for students to enter, and the first prize will be £150, and there'll also be five other prizes worth £20.
Are the winning poems going to be published?
The winning poems are allowed to be published by the Brighton and Hove Arts Council on our website. They still, of course, remain the property of the individual, but the rules of the competition allow us to publish them on the website for thousands of other people to enjoy.
And what about the other entries? Presumably, if you've had 600 entries, I don't suppose you can really publish them all, can you?
We will only be able to publish, I'm afraid, the winning entries. But when you think about it, in the open competition, there will be seven winning entries, if I can put it like that. And in the student category, there will be six winning entries. So we'll publish them all. Sadly, we can't publish all 600.
Nor are there any plans to actually print them?
No plans at the moment. We're going down the digital route. In this day and age, it is so much easier, of course, to publish any sort of literature online.
As you said, it will make the poems available to quite a wide audience.
Yes. We're really hoping, again, to draw in a further, wider audience, Brighton, Hove and all round Sussex, so they can see exactly the extent of the art going on in the city and in the county. And maybe, and hopefully, it will encourage more people to be as creative as our entrants.
So the competition is over, but the one-day festival is still to come.
It is, and we're very excited about our festival. It will take place at the Old Market in Hove. We've booked out the entire place. That's the entire theatre, which can seat 300 people. People can also enjoy drinks at Tom's Bar. And the programme itself is very exciting. To kick us off, we have Cameron Tung, which is a well-known poetry sort of slam collection, shall I say, run by a great guy called Michael Parker. And he'll be bringing along a variety of local poets, and that will be great entertainment to kick us off. We then are going to have a slam competition that will involve the students. A slam competition is whereby various individuals read out their poems and then people vote as to what they think is the best poem. And whoever wins, I'm not sure whether they get a prize or not, but they'll certainly get the sort of a warm glow of being the Poetry Festival Slam winner. We will then have a break, and we will then announce the winners of the competition. So someone out of the 600 will win £1,000, and that prize will be given by the Poet Laureate, Carol Ann Duffy.
Oh, so you've got a real celebrity coming along then. You can't get much more of a celebrity than the Poet Laureate, I would think.
We were incredibly lucky to get Carol Ann Duffy, and we feel really sort of privileged and honoured that she would come along to our poetry festival. And we think it sort of it makes a statement about the value and importance of poetry and running the festival here in Brighton. And probably, let's be honest, has attracted a large number of people to compete. And we're really hoping, of course, to sell out the place.
So you've told us where it's taking place. When is it?
The Poetry Festival will take place on Saturday, November the 18th. It kicks off at 4, but by all means you can get there earlier and enjoy the ambience. There'll be some music going on, some live jazz going on in Tom's Bar. And then we'll kick off at 4. There'll be various sort of performances, intermissions. We've got Attila the Stockbroker. He'll be doing his own anarchic poetry. And then, of course, the climax of the show will be Carol Ann Duffy and her colleague John Sampson, that will be performing between 7 and 8.
And presumably the winning poems will be read.
The winning poems will be read out by the individuals themselves. If they don't want to read them out themselves, there'll be plenty of people who will do it for them. So if people are, how can I put it, a little shy in front of an audience, we'll have lots of talented people who will read out their poems.
And how do people get tickets?
People can apply to the Old Market, to the box office there, on 01273 201 801, or of course they can go online at theoldmarket.com. The tickets are £20.
If I remember rightly from our previous interview, this is the first time you've actually run this festival.
We've run a competition before, but this is the very first time we've run a festival. I'm fingers crossed and I'm touching wood. It's all going fantastically well, and I'm just hoping on the day that it'll be as exciting as we all hope it will be.
Apart from anything else, it's a chance to actually meet Caroline Duffy.
Yes, I think it is a sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to not only listen to Caroline Duffy, read her poems, not only to find out her ideas on poetry, but potentially to meet the Poet Laureate. And also, of course, to hear lots of other sort of great poetry and to sort of soak in the atmosphere of poetry and the various poets in the area. I'm really looking forward to this event. I think it's going to be a fantastic event. It's going to be great fun, and we won't be running another one for at least a year, so I would encourage people to buy.
Well, thanks very much for telling us all that, Jason. I hope the festival is a great success. I'm sure it will be, and hopefully it'll become an annual event. I've been talking to Jason Squire of Brighton and Hove Arts Council about their forthcoming poetry festival. I'll just remind you of the details. The festival is on November the 18th, starting at 4 p.m. in the Old Market in Hove. And to get tickets, you can phone the Old Market on Brighton 201 801, that's 01273 201 801. You can go to the Old Market's website, which is theoldmarket.com, that's theoldmarket, typed all as one word, .com, and you can call in at the Old Market at times when they're open. Jason, thanks once again for giving us all that information. And that brings us to the end of our programme for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time. But in the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me to let me know what you think of the programme, or perhaps to suggest items you might like me to cover in future editions, I'd love to hear from you. There are two ways of getting in touch. You can either contact me by email at the following address, info@greymattersproductions.org.uk. That's info, spelt I-N-F-O, at greymattersproductions.org. Which is typed all as one word, .org.uk. Or you can contact me via the Radio Reverb website. If you go to the website and find the page that's devoted to At Home This Morning, you can send me an email from there. And whichever method you choose, I'd love to hear from you. Well, it now only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, to thank everyone who's taken part in the programme. Once again, to thank you for listening, and until we meet again, to wish you all the very best. Goodbye.
At Home This Morning is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb.